Time now for Labor Press, your source for daily labor news and industry information. Hear discussions on the workplace and interesting talk from prominent and influential personalities in the labor community. And now your hosts, Neil Tippel and Bill Holfeld.
Accountability. Good evening and welcome to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz right here on AM 970 The Answer. And this is the program that tells you the story of everyday working people and their daily struggles. And with us today in the studio, we have a very special guest, an old friend of mine, Steve Levine. Steve and I were colleagues teaching together down at the Van Arsdale Center years ago, and I remember when Steve gave brilliant seminars on prevailing wage legislation when he was with the School Construction Authority. But he is now on his own, and he is the president and CEO of Prolective Solutions. And welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Great to be here, Bill.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing over there at Prolective Solutions and the direction that you're taking your company.
Sure. Well, in last week's edition of Blue Collar Buzz, Economic Policy Institute President Larry Michel spoke about the issue and the changes over time of minority and Latino employment in the New York City construction industry. Minority and Latino union membership trends and minority and union construction apprenticeship training program enrollment. Back in the 80s, I handled hundreds and hundreds of cases and negotiations as a New York State labor mediator, arbitrator, and administrative law judge with the New York State Mediation Board. And then in 1989, I joined the New York City School Construction Authority and soon became the director of labor law compliance, which translates to prevailing wage compliance, which is another subject all by itself.
So when we say that you're a prevailing wage expert, we are not stretching the truth in any way, shape, or form.
As a matter of fact, I was told, I was at a law enforcement training last week, a labor enforcement training to be specific, and I was told that during those years at the SCA, I was one of the most feared government construction compliance enforcement professionals in all of the New York City metropolitan area. And I understand that fear. A lot of hard-working construction workers get cheated out of their hard-earned wages.
So let's get right down to the nitty-gritty then. So lots of workers, you're telling me, aren't receiving the proper wages and benefits that they're supposed to get. Tell me, why is that?
Well, there are a lot of bad players, bad contractors out there. The penalties for noncompliance can be steep, including steep legal fees. Penalties can include debarment of the firm, meaning that the firm can no longer bid on any public government contract work. The penalties can include massive fines. And yes, the penalties can and do include felony imprisonment. And as a government official, I had the primary responsibility for assuring that the 10,000 construction workers every month on SCA sites were paid correctly. But contractors who do government construction work, such as building schools, highways, subways, and bridges and tunnels, are required to pay their workers what the government says each trade must be paid. That's what that prevailing wage means. A laborer is paid differently than a carpenter, who's paid differently than a painter, who's paid differently from an electrician, for example. And the government has a different wage and benefit schedule with the rates for every trade for every locality. And the proper schedule is required to be posted at every construction site.
Okay, let me just jump in there for a second, Steve, and because I'm sure that there are some people out there that don't really know the background. So just give us, not a whole history lesson, but just give us a little bit of background on how prevailing wage came about, because there are plenty of naysayers out there that would say, oh, this is just special interest unions trying to get their people paid. And you and I know that that's not the truth. So give some of our listeners a little bit of background as to how that all came about.
To be sure, the reality is that in the late 1800s, going back almost a century and a half ago, the public was having construction done, a new firehouse, for example, and the locality went and contracted with a contractor to go and do a building to build that firehouse. And that contractor obviously was under some feeling that he was going to go and kick back some of that money to the government official who went and contracted for that firehouse to be built. And that contractor went and put a note out there for carpenters to do the work. And where the prevailing wage was actually, believe it or not, at that point, about 17 or 18 cents an hour, the contractor went and said, you can have the job for 10 cents an hour. Mm-hmm. Well, the local carpenters out there went to the contractor and said, well, you know, our wage rate here is not 10 cents an hour, it's 17 cents. That's what we need to go and provide for our families, to provide for our kids, to do the proper job, to pay whatever we needed to do. And the contractor said, take the job or leave it. And they left it. They couldn't afford to take the job for 10 cents. And what happened, believe it or not, in this particular case that I read about, that when they built the firehouse and opened the door for the first time, they went and pulled the string for the bell, and the bell came down along with the roof. So
we got shoddy construction. When you pay 10 cents an hour instead of 17 cents an hour, you get shoddy construction.
That's exactly. And so laws came in effect to go and create the wages which are prevailing. And prevailing in construction, as far as the New York State Constitution is concerned, says that where a labor organization represents at least 30% of the workers doing that kind of work in that jurisdiction, then that labor organization's contract is what becomes the prevailing wage in that geographic community. And so there's a different wage for the carpenters and for the painters and whatever else. And when there is no labor organization that represents at least 30%, then it's this done by survey of all contractors doing that kind of work.
Okay. So tell me how this dovetailed for you when you were over at the School Construction Authority.
Well, as a certified fraud examiner, Bill, I was responsible for assuring that all of those workers on our job sites went and actually got paid properly. And it's a tough job. We had at the SCA, and I believe they still currently have about 2,500 approved contractors doing work. And some of them are great. In fact, the majority of them are great. But there are too many bad players out there who seek to go through all sorts of schemes to defraud their workers.
But why? I mean, why? I mean, we've made it so clear cut. It's so easy to follow the rules. And again, I've been at your seminars where you lay out for any new contractor. It's a great seminar. You tell all the rules, all the regs, exactly the way the players are supposed to act. In spite of that, we still get so many bad players. Why?
The reality is that I like to joke about the fact that if you drive on the New Jersey parkways, you'll very frequently see the Garden State Parkway, you'll see buses traveling down on that highway heading to Atlantic City. And you see buses coming back the other way with losers on it. But there are lots and lots of contractors who are basically gamblers and hope to make a killing on the backs of their workers. And that's really the bottom line. Of course, there are others that are just ignorant as far as the rules are concerned. They have never done public work. They may have done small offices, maybe done homework, home construction, maybe some local stores and things of that nature. And they say, doing public work is now my chance at the big time. And so they go into public work thinking that they're going to pay the same employees that they have, the same $15 or $20 an hour that they've been paying them. And they base their bids on that. And they go ahead into these jobs which require prevailing wage compliance, and there's no way they can possibly make ends meet. That's why I did the training at the School Construction Authority specifically aimed at new contractors, and that's what I'm doing now with Prolective.com, because there are good contractors out there who really want to know the right way to do it. And certainly government agencies, as helpful as they may be, can't spend the time that's necessary to work with a company, to go over their books, to show their hiring methods, to look at how their office is processing things, to look at the completion of certified payroll forms, which are the documents that they submit to government agencies showing what they're doing. You just can't get that kind of personalized help from going to a government agency. And so they hire me and my firm, Prolective.com, to go into there and sit down with their workers, their office workers, their back office workers, and their field supervisors, superintendents, things of that nature, to do the training so that they become aware of all the requirements that are out there.
And sure, because and I can understand that, because if I'm a legitimate contractor and I'm not trying to scam anybody, and I'm coming into doing public sector work for the first time in my career, there are a tremendous number of subtleties that I may not understand. So I may not – I understand that I need a pipe fitter, but I don't know if this is the steam fitter's work or if it's the plumber's work. I don't know if this belongs to the carpenters or the – so I don't know some of the jurisdictional stuff, which all have slightly different wage rates and slightly different benefit packages. And so you're telling me that I make one phone call to you and you guide me through this process.
More than that, to be sure, I wish it were that easy. Because the rules and regulations change every week. And if I'm not staying on top of all the requirements, and that's just this one area of prevailing wage, forget about all the issues of construction and materials and safety and everything else that they have to be aware of. If they're not aware of these areas, they can get themselves in all sorts of trouble. And that's why they rely on me doing the background homework, working with their law firms, working with their accountants to educate them about what needs to be done so that everybody is not working as a single team to go and do the job right.
So Prolective is also proactive. You're on top of things. And when those changes come about, and they can come about at a very rapid rate, then these are the types of changes that you make your clients aware of so that they don't find themselves outside the law.
It's more than that. The bottom line is that those contractors risk so much if they don't do it right. And stupid things can really hurt them and cost them thousands and thousands of dollars. And it can be somebody who's in the office who just doesn't know it right, who hasn't been trained properly, and they're eager to do it right. That's why they call us.
And the secondary thing that comes out of all of this is you really are doing a public service as well, because by keeping these people informed and keeping them within the guidelines of the way they're supposed to do the job, the public who's paying for this with their hard-earned tax dollars are actually getting, in the long run, a much better job done.
And as long as you're putting in a pitch, I will say I don't want to work with bad contractors, contractors who intentionally go and cheat their workers and then get caught and then want somebody to go and help them. I'm not in that business. I'm there to work with the best and to make them even better.
Okay. Well, Steve, listen, before we wrap this up, just one more time, why don't you give us a phone number and a website where if there is somebody who's looking to get into the public sector market here and do some legitimate construction work and they want some help, where can they find you?
They can find Prolective Solutions at Prolective, that's Prolective.com. And phone number is area code 631-741-8469. 631-741-8469.
Steve, thank you so much for being with us. And we will be back in just a minute with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer.
Dennis Prager sees yet another double standard from the left.
The reaction of people on the left to the revelation by Vice President Mike Pence that he does not dine alone with a woman other than his wife. If Pence were a Muslim and this was their culture, the left would be gushing about how wonderful it is.
The Dennis Prager Show, weekdays at 1, right before Michael Medved at 3 on AM 970. The Answer.
Hi, this is Bill Martinez. Join us as the conversation continues about immigration, about our healthcare system. It's all about us. It's all about the truth, wherever it leads.
Bill Martinez live, Monday mornings at 12 a.m. on AM 970, The Answer.
If you're a CPAP user, soap and water cleaning may leave harmful bacteria, viruses, and mold that can make you sick. That alone will keep you up at night. Until now, SoClean.com is the world's first and only automated hands-free CPAP cleaner and sanitizer. SoClean kills 99.9% of all CPAP germs without soap, water, harsh chemicals, or even equipment disassembly. And now you can try it risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-953-4545.
SoClean changed the CPAP experience for the better. My health has improved. It's simple to use, and I'm not worried about infections.
SoClean's revolutionary design makes it easy to clean your CPAP and protect you against CPAP-related illnesses. Plus, SoClean works with all popular CPAP devices to clean them in minutes. It really is that easy. Don't risk your health. Call SoClean.com now to try it risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-953-4545. This offer won't last. Call now. 800-953-4545. 800-953-4545.
Our hosts all look like GQ models. See them now at AM970TheAnswer.com.
Welcome back to Labor Press, the show about labor and the laborer. Here are your hosts, Neil Tappel and Bill Holfeld.
And we're back with Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz, and our next guest that we have on the line is Wayne Spence, and he is the president of the Public Employees Federation, and he represents New York State parole offices. Hi, Wayne. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing, sir?
Okay, good. So now I understand that, you know, very high up on your political agenda, if you want to put it that way, is Senate Bill, New York State Senate Bill 407 and Assembly Bill 1644, which is commonly known as the parity bill. Am I correct?
That's correct, sir.
And could you explain to our listeners exactly what that is and why this is so important to you and the people that you represent?
It's a bill that will give parole officers who do a lot of law enforcement work, the majority of the work is law enforcement work, but similar work to what police officers do and probation officers do, give them line of duty injury, similar to what the police have, meaning that if they were injured on the job, instead of going on workers' compensation, which is like what teachers do or others, they will get exactly what a corrections officer does, a police officer does, which is they remain on sick time without having to go on workers' comp, which is a percentage of salary, until they are well or are seen by a surgeon and can return to work.
Okay. Well, all right. Then let's explain to our audience, you know, the rationale behind this, because most of us are covered by workers' comp. I know for years in my job as a construction worker, if I got hurt, I would be covered under workers' comp. So explain to us the rationale why a parole officer and or a police officer should get full pay instead of a normal workers' compensation rate.
Well, the reason why is that the inherent danger that comes with the job. Most people don't get out of bed and put on a vest and go out to work day and put on a sidearm, and job is to go into high-speed chases, or job is to run down a hallway, run across rooftops, and chase felons and apprehend them. And that is one of the main charges of a parole officer, and at times a police officer. We are out there putting ourselves in harm's way. So many times police officers are involved in situations where they're fighting with people, or they're making risky things.
Okay, so you know the danger element is certainly present there. There's no doubt about that. So tell us about how long has this been in the process? How long has this process been in the works? I should say. How long have parole officers been trying to get this parity bill passed?
We've been trying for over 30 years to get it passed, and I think we finally made headway when parole and New York State Department of Corrections were formed and merged into one. So parole officers now are part of the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. Community Supervision is a part in the name that represents the parole officers and what we do. And I want to tell you that in DOCS, are the same agency, corrections officers who work inside of a correctional facility have line of duty injury. Same exact thing. And I'm not going to badmouth them, but their line of duty injury is simple. They could be walking down the steps, and if they fall or slip, they get hurt. We're not even asking for that. We're asking that we be compensated if it's in direct thing. If we were to walk down the steps at the parole office and fall and slip, we're not asking for line of duty injury. We're asking for line of duty injury when we're involved in apprehending somebody, not if we were to just fall down in the normal course of walking to your car or walking down the hallway.
Oh, okay, well, I'm sure that that's a very big distinction for most people. I mean, I think most people could understand that. If you're engaged in the process of apprehending a dangerous criminal, then by all means, you should be compensated properly if you're hurt in that process.
Yeah, we decided to do that because we think the taxpayer, we understand what tax, I'm a taxpayer, and right now, so there's a different distinction. And again, I'm not this time paraging, but if you're a police officer, during the normal course of business, you step out of your car to go do a parking ticket and you bend or you break your ankle or you twist your ankle, that's a That is a line of duty injury, the way their bill is written. So I'm not going to belittle them and say I'm jealous of them. But I recognize that we want to be compensated when we're involved in it. Recently, in the village of Newburgh, parole officers are knocking on somebody's door to check on a parolee, and as they're going up the steps in Newburgh, a pit bull came at them. An officer, they started backpedaling down the steps. They shot the dog because the dog was trying to bite them. But as they shoot the dog still came at them. They both tumbled down the steps. And they're both hurt. They both had to go to the hospital in Newburgh, and they've been out of work for 3 weeks now. It's going to take some time for them to get back to work. That is, again, they're on workers' compensation, a percentage of salary.
Right now, and absolutely, that's an excellent example. You make a strong point with that particular example. I think everybody could identify with that. So tell us a little bit about what's going on in Albany. Who's on your side? Who's not on your side? Where is the legislation at this point?
Two occasions. The legislation made it both out of the Senate and the Assembly, and it was both times it made it to the governor's desk, and both times the governor vetoed it. His veto message was that there was a cost associated with it, and there's only 850 parole officers in New York State. By the way, I want to let you know that this bill actually gained some notoriety and attention when a parole officer in Brooklyn was shot in the chest while he was at his desk. So it's Sam Salters. Salters was shot. Salters is back to work. Salters was out for a year, and he went on to workers' comp. So I got plenty of cases where officers have been hurt on the job doing the same exact work as a parole officer. I was transporting a prisoner to Rikers Island, and we got rear-ended while transporting a prisoner to Rikers Island in a state vehicle. I went out on workers' comp. And the police officers who came to my aid and transported me, they were saying, "Well, you know, take it easy. Where you were?" I said, "I got to get." He says, "What do you say, make sure you're straight." I said, "I don't have the luxury of making sure I'm straight. I got to get back to work because I cannot survive on 60% of salary."
Right, and I understand that because I mean, very early on in my career, I was a New York City building tradesman. Very early on in my career, I was very badly injured, and I went out on compensation, and I had just bought a house.
Yeah,
and I almost lost that house from being out of work for a year.
Yeah.
And hold on one second, because I've got a special guest with me, joining me in the studio today, Cliff Tucker, and he's an expert on this because he's from Fisher Injury Lawyers, and he has his two cents that he wants to put in.
Sure.
The points that you're raising really strike a chord for two reasons. Number one, as Bill said, as you said, the workers' compensation rates of reimbursement are low and put a particular strain on the injured person and their family. Also, the parole officers, just like police officers and firefighters, often find themselves on other people's property and encountering or putting themselves at risk from, frankly, the negligence of others. I'll give you an example. If you mentioned chasing a suspect on a rooftop, well, if that rooftop is improperly built or improperly secured, not safe, not maintained, the officer who's doing their job could get badly hurt. Just you mentioned someone with a dog coming after them. Well, homeowners insurance would cover instances where vicious dogs attack a person, and we all know that dogs, especially a pit bull, can cause some serious, probably permanent damage.
Yeah. So it seems to me, Wayne, like you've got some really strong legal background. We got a brilliant legal mind here, saying that you're on pretty firm ground.
Can I also add one more thing, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Well, you also talked about the cost to the state, and I would like to say, you know, that workers' compensation benefits are reimbursed in third-party actions, and I believe that these types of actions for line of duty benefits may also fall under that line of reimbursement. So, to the extent there are third-party cases, they would reimburse the cost of the taxpayer.
Wayne, before we leave you, just tell us what you're expecting to happen in the near future with this bill, because we want to know.
We are going to put the bills back out. We think we have bipartisan support, like we did the last two times, and we're going to. Hopefully, this time the governor will do it. But to make sure of this, we're going to educate the taxpayers, the citizens of New York, my neighbors, as to what we're going to do. HBO did a special about 5 years ago, actually 12 years ago. It was called Unsung Heroes, where parole officers were followed for about a month in Brooklyn on special operations. I was a part of a unit. This unit was designed for several things. It was designed to get guns and drugs off the table. I mean, off the table, off the streets. Here was the idea. A parolee comes into my office, and he's drug tested. If he's dirty for drugs, it means that he used drugs, right? Well, so it didn't fall out the sky. He actually had to buy from someplace. We knew that guns and drugs go together. The drug dealers use guns to protect their drugs. So we basically tell these guys, listen, we don't want to violate you, but we're not going to sit here, and we're not just going to keep offering you just drug treatment. You want drug treatment, you got to earn it.
Wayne, is there a phone number or, you know, you want to get through to the governor, so is there a phone number or a website that people can go to and get educated, as you said, before we wrap this up?
Yes, well, we are going to be putting out on PEF.org, PEF.org. You come to our PEF website, and it will give you the links to the governor to get the governor to act on this thing. We feel that we do the same work. We may keep New Yorkers safe, and we are fighting to get guns and drugs off the street.
Well, we thank you for all you're doing, and we wish you the very best of luck, and we urge everybody to go to that website and make their voice heard to our governor. Thank you so much. And we will be back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970 The Answer in just a moment.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970 The Answer.
News, opinion, passion. This is AM 970 The Answer.
It's mostly cloudy and 54 degrees. What's going on? We have the answer. Officials are investigating the cause of a basement fire that killed a man in his New Jersey home. Michael Bauer has the story.
The blaze broke out shortly after 8 a.m. in the basement of the home at 338 Riverlawn Drive, and it spread through the rest of the house to the car and a trailer parked in the driveway. The 70-year-old victim had gone downstairs to inspect the fire but became trapped. Officials say the victim's wife and two dogs escaped safely, but he and a third dog went back into the building. The man and the family's dog were both found dead inside the home. Michael Bauer, NBC News Radio, New York.
Two men are recovering after being attacked by a hammer-wielding assailant during an argument over man-spreading. The two were on a Queensbound J train Friday night when they asked a stranger taking up two seats to move over. The argument escalated into a fight that ended when one of the man-spreader's friends pulled out a hammer and began attacking the two victims. The suspects fled when the train pulled into the Bowery station. Both of the victims are expected to survive. Friday's incident comes as the NYPD is fighting back against a 20% increase in attacks on the city's subway system. In sports, in the NHL, Islanders beat the Ottawa Senators 4-2, and the Mets are now at the bottom of the third inning, and they are leading Miami 3-2. Yankees beat the Orioles 7-3. In traffic delays, well, expect some delays at the FDR Drive northbound at the RFK Triborough Bridge. There was an earlier accident. Looks like traffic stop and go from 79th Street. Also on the Harlem River Drive, there are delays from 5th Avenue to 2nd Avenue. Head over to the West Side Highway instead. At the GWB upper level inbound, there was an accident, 20-minute delays. Lower level looks to be a little bit better. Looks like the Lincoln Tunnel's not a bad ride. Holland has delays outbound of 15 to 20 minutes. Weather for tonight, mostly clear, low 47 degrees, mostly sunny tomorrow, high 74. You now know what's going on. I'm Amy Salerno and AM 970 The Answer.
Want to listen to AM 970 The Answer on the go? There's an app for that. Download our free smartphone app so you can listen to all your favorite shows, keep up with us on social media, enter contests, win prizes, and even interact with our hosts all in one place. Just search AM 970 The Answer in the iPhone App Store or the Google Play Store for the Android. Again, search AM 970 The Answer and download our smartphone app today. That way, you can take us wherever you go. This is Labor Press. And now back to your hosts, Neil Tappel and Bill Holfeld.
Taking care of business every day. Taking care of business and working overtime.
Hi, and we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970 The Answer. I'm Bill Holfeld, your host, and joining us now is Ms. Jennifer Penrose from the Polaris Organization. And welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, I have to say, I just read your most recent report on and it's a shocking word, on slavery that's taking place right here in the United States. And that's not a word most of us are particularly comfortable with. Could you tell us a little bit about that report, please?
Sure. So Polaris operates the U.S. Human Trafficking Hotline. So we're the organization tasked by the federal government with answering calls from people all over the country to report cases of forced labor or forced commercial sex. And we've been operating this hotline since December of 2007. And since that time, we've had about 33,000 cases of human trafficking and about 10,000 cases of labor exploitation that have been reported to our hotline. And so we took a step back and analyzed the data in the aggregate to look for different trends and patterns. And we just released a report that is a typology of those 25 different types of forced labor and forced commercial sex that we see here in the U.S.
Well, I have to tell you, Jennifer, I just finished reading your report just this morning, as a matter of fact. And it was chilling. There's no other word for it. It's absolutely chilling. I mean, I think when most people think of that type of slavery that goes on, I think their mind usually goes to, you know, the porn industry or prostitution. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more. Tell us about some of the more unusual ones that our mind doesn't normally go to.
Sure. And I think that's one of the things we really wanted to illuminate with this report is just the diversity of industries and sectors touched by forced labor. Because you're right, most people don't necessarily think of traveling carnivals, for example, or construction or landscaping or restaurants. But these are all types where we've heard directly from survivors about experiencing forced labor, whether they were forced to work, like I said, on a traveling carnival, going around the country. We also see people who are forced to work selling magazines door to door. And these are not necessarily, like you said, the kinds of sectors where you might expect to encounter victims. But it's so important that people understand where we are seeing trafficking so that they're more likely to recognize and be able to report these types of cases to us.
So, I mean, what I found chilling, and you mentioned the traveling sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just have this picture of sort of sitting home on a Saturday afternoon. You're in a nice suburb. Your doorbell rings. You go out to answer the door, and there's nice looking, young person out there on your doorstep. And you're telling me that this could very possibly be somebody who's working in slave conditions.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the more common types of labor trafficking that's reported to our hotline. And it's a little unusual because we see a pretty high percentage of U.S. citizen victims. So with other types, you might see foreign nationals and people who were brought into the U.S. by their trafficker. But in these door-to-door sales, we see a lot of U.S. citizen victims who are kind of recruited from impoverished backgrounds, often in rural areas, and then brought onto these crews where they're taken far away from home, and they face really strict sales quotas, and they're told, if you try to leave or if you want to leave, you'll experience physical abuse. We have a lot of sexual abuse of female workers on these crews, and so it is a type that a lot of people have perhaps encountered because they are going door to door, and they are, like you said, going to suburban homes trying to sell magazines.
And let's go to the coercion aspect of this for a mm-hmm. second, because one of the things that I had difficulty wrapping my head around as I was reading the report is I can understand if someone is in the country and they're undocumented because mm-hmm. you have this, obviously, you have this natural hammer that you can hold over their
mm-hmm.
head, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of
sure.
understood that. But I was shocked at the high percentage in some of these segments, not all of them, but in mm-hmm. some of the segments, how high a percentage were, you know, American citizens. And
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to be real naive to give you the opportunity to answer the question, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't these people just leave?
Mm-hmm. And I think your use of the word coercion is so important there because you're right that we're not necessarily always seeing physical or sexual abuse. We absolutely do see those present in trafficking cases, but in many cases it's much more psychological manipulation and coercion where people are threatened with lots of different things. It may not just be immigration, especially with sex trafficking victims, they're threatened. If you go to the police, they won't believe you. They'll just arrest you as a prostitute. We'll have cases where people are first recruited by a trafficker who presents as a boyfriend or an intimate partner. And so, similar to domestic violence, there's this strong psychological bond that they have with the abuser, and it's very hard to leave because of that coercive element. And we'll also see cases where people are, their family members are threatened by the trafficker, or they're told we'll expose the embarrassing things you did while you were in the trafficking situation. And also many victims are put in situations where they have to rely completely on their trafficker. So going back to traveling south situations, they're often taken very far from home, and the trafficker is the only person they know who can provide them with transportation and shelter. And so if they try to leave, where do they go? Where do they even go to get help? And so that's why, again, we really want to raise awareness about the hotline number, because for so many people, maybe they could leave, but they have no idea where they could go and where they could be safe.
Okay, so walk us a little bit through the process. In other words, you have the hotline, a call comes in. Give us, in other words, give us a day in the life. How is the hotline working, and how is it contacted, and what happens as a result?
Sure. So the hotline has a few different ways people can reach out for help. One is by calling the 1-888-3737-888 number. So you can call that hotline. It's 24 hours a day. We also have an online web form people can submit if you've seen something suspicious, or you can email us. And then we have a text number that is BEFREE. So if you text to Be Free, that will also reach us. And so there are different ways that people can contact us for help. And on any given day, we're taking around 100-120 different calls, where people are calling in from all over the country. And every call honestly looks different depending on the situation. It's everything from a mother who's calling because her 14-year-old daughter is missing, and she saw an ad for her on the website back page where commercial sex sometimes is facilitated, and so she's obviously alarmed and worried about her daughter, all the way to a domestic worker who's been held by an abusive employer in their home for 14 years, and she just learned of the hotline number, and so she's calling to see if there's options for her or ways she can get help. And the hotline provides everything from tip reporting, so helping to pass on information to trained, trusted law enforcement, to connecting people with legal services, connecting people with emergency shelter and case management, and just providing emotional support and safety planning with callers when they contact us.
Those are a lot of tentacles you've got out there, into public service. And talk for a second about the police officers. I mean, I imagine that there must be a whole segment of the law enforcement community that's receiving special training, because this isn't the kind of thing that we would normally expect.
Absolutely. And when I first started with Polaris many years ago, it was a really different situation where a lot of law enforcement weren't trained on trafficking, or if they were trained, it was only on a few of the different types. And we've seen that change significantly, where more and more law enforcement are trained on this, and there are special task forces around the country specifically dedicated to working on cases of human trafficking. And so one component of the hotline is that it's one central number where we can help connect people to those specific officers or specific task forces in their area who are focused on trafficking and know how to respond. And so we have robust response protocols across the country for those cases.
And Jennifer, I mean, would you hazard a guess? I mean, how many tens or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of industry are we talking about that's being supported by this slave labor?
So the one estimate I can quote on that is from the International Labor Organization, and this is a global estimate, so that's one component to keep in mind. But they estimate it's about $150 billion a year generated in this, and it's kind of considered the third largest criminal enterprise, and so it's a very profitable sector.
And how much of this do they have any idea is like organized crime or just freelancers, if you will?
It varies by type, and that's one component we saw when we were analyzing the 25 different types, and that's really a helpful framework because different law enforcement will respond differently depending on that. So we absolutely will see ties to more organized criminal activity and organized gangs, and then we'll also see a significant proportion of more opportunistic or individual, and I think that's probably the larger overall.
And that's what we would suspect. Jennifer, thank you so much for all the work you do. And just real quickly, one more time before we say goodbye, mm-hmm. give us the website or the text again so that if somebody needs to reach you, they can.
Sure. So the phone number is 888-373-7888, and the text number is the word Be Free, so B-E-F-R-E-E, and our website is polarisproject.org.
Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us, and we will be back in just a second with more good talk here on AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer.
Joe Walsh places blame where it's supposed to be.
The reason America is a morally and financially bankrupt country, primarily a country of a lot of people, too damn many people, who cannot take care of themselves, and they are dependent upon government,
who are so easily offended by everything,
is because of us. We are a country full of people who have grown fat, lazy, and stupid.
The Joe Walsh Show, weeknights at 9, right before Eric Metaxas at 11, on AM 970. The Answer.
How would you describe your health care? If you're like most Americans these days, the word affordable isn't top of mind. Well, here's some good news. There's actually a trusted health care option that is affordable. It's called MediShare. Unlike insurance, MediShare is Christian health care sharing, a community of more than 200,000 believers across America who share each other's medical expenses. It's about half the cost of insurance, and it's fully acceptable under the law. And here's the best part. Because MediShare is based on biblical principles, you never pay for things that go against your beliefs. MediShare is affordable health care for Christians.
Learn how thousands of Christians can help you save on your health care. For your free information guide, call 844-41-BIBLE. Not available in Montana. MediShare, affordable biblical health care. Call 844-41-BIBLE. That's 844-41-BIBLE.
Hi, this is Mitchell Modell. Don't miss out on incredible prices of Modell Sporting Goods. 25% off select Nike for the family. Two for $20 polo shirts or performance tees and shorts from Unipro. 50% off men's N1 basketball shorts, now $10. Plus three for $20 Champion women tees, tanks, and shorts. Save $10 to $15 on select footwear and choose from new Nike or Adidas soccer packages, $39.99. Unbelievable savings on baseball and softball, too. Remember, to get in the game, you got to go to Mo's.
You have labor questions? They have answers. Labor Press.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970 The Answer. And I'm really happy about our next guest because, you know, sometimes we can be a little doom and gloom here on Labor Press, talking about the rough ways of the world and how labor has to fight its way to the top. Well, we have a slightly different tack that we're going to take right now. And with us in the station today, in the studio today, we have station agent Teresa Green. Welcome to the program, Teresa.
Hi, thank you.
And Teresa, I am proud to say, is the epitome of what we would call a public servant. And because Teresa just recently went way out of her way to make sure that one of our riders right there on the MTA got everything she needed. So, Teresa, you can probably tell a story a lot better than I do. Why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners what happened?
Well, I was working at my booth at Times Square. I worked there 5 days a week. And a woman came over to my window, and she was a little, I would say, excited. And she, not excited, I would say she was a little panicky. And so she's like, oh, I left my bag on the 7 train that just left. So I get that often. People leave their bag, their cell phones. So I just went into action mode, and I called the station command center to let them know, to notify the conductor that she had left this bag. She gave me a description of the bag. So that was it. So they said, hey, well, call me back in about 20 minutes. We'll check to find out if it was returned to the conductor or anyone, you know, sees it on the train. So I called back, and they told me the bad news. No.
But you didn't stop there. You didn't let that stop you.
No, I didn't. I said, you know, usually when people find things, they don't turn it in where they find it. They take it where they're getting off the train at.
Well, sure, it makes sense.
And they'll turn it into the booth there. So I said, you know what, let me call all of the stations between 42nd and the last stop before I tell her they didn't find her bag. So I did that. I called every station, and I told them that I was the station agent at Times Square. So if someone did turn it into them, please just give me a call here.
So you called every station in between, let me get this straight, between Times Square and Flushing?
Yeah, like 21 stations.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. So you were on a mission. You were going to get this woman's bag back if it was at all possible.
Yeah. Because she said she had her medicine in it. And then she also told me that she had just collected, like, rent money. And she had it in that bag. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. So I called everyone. And then I called the dispatcher's office as well. And that's at the last stop. So he says, hey, no one turned anything. Every station said no one turned anything. So at this time, the police were there to take a report. So they walked away, and she says, well, I'm going to give you my number just in case someone turns it in. And they notify you. So I said, okay, fine. So she didn't give me the number right away, and she walks away. And she was out of my sight. And about 15, 20 minutes later, the dispatcher calls me. And he says, hey, I have the bag. It was a Whole Foods shopping bag.
Okay.
And he says, yeah, we have it. So I said, okay, great. He says, it's like 8:30. You're at Times Square. I'm getting ready to get off. I'll bring the bag to you.
So the other station agent brought the bag to you, delivered it to you?
No, actually, it's the dispatcher. The dispatcher is someone who works like in the tower, and he has something he has to do with the conductor and the train operator.
Okay.
So his job is to work at the last stop.
Okay.
So he says, I'll bring it to you. So I said, fine. So I'm waiting for him to come, and then 5 minutes later, she comes back, and she was coming back to give me her phone number. And I said, hey, guess what? I said, they found your bag. She was like, oh, so she was excited now at that point.
I bet.
So I says, the dispatcher's on his way from Flushing. It's going to take him probably about half an hour to get here, 40 minutes tops. So she says, okay. So she says, I'm going to go upstairs and get some coffee. I said, okay, do that. Just relax yourself, because I know she was probably, you know.
She was a nervous wreck.
Yeah, nervous wreck, exactly. So as she left, maybe a half an hour, he came with the bag, and she hadn't returned yet. So I took the bag for her and kept it until she came, till she returned. And then she came, and she got the bag. And most of her money was there. They had taken her wallet and one of the envelopes that she had money in. But her medicine was there, and the other items that she had in the bag was all there. So she was pretty happy because, you know, medicine these days is not cheap.
Right.
So
she got her medication bag plus most of her cash.
Yeah. So I guess whoever, I don't know if it was someone on the train or, because the conductor turned in the bag to the dispatcher. He said that it was left on the train.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, that's an incredible story. The fact that you called 21 different stations until you got the right answer, that shows real persistence.
Yeah. I think... you know, like when they say they're going to call the conductor and find out if he sees an item on the train, I don't know what that entails. Like, is the conductor going to come out of his cab?
You're right.
And go to the car? If he just doesn't see it, he says it's not there, or does he ask the people on the train? Anyone left a bag here? Did anyone pick up a bag that was left here? So I don't know how that goes.
So Teresa, tell me, how long have you been working with the MTA?
I'm going on my 28th year in December.
Wow. So you're a long-time veteran with the agency.
Yeah. And when I find things or people turn things into me, I really go out of my way to try to return it to them, wallets or anything that has an ID that you can say, okay, this goes to this person, your license or something. You know, you can always drop it in the mail because the system, their process is a whole lot slower than mine.
Apparently. And what local are you a member of?
Local 100.
You know, and Teresa, you know what's so great about this story is unions are so often portrayed as special interest groups, and they're just, you know, and they're just agencies that are greedy, and all they care about is how much money they make, and they don't care about other people, they don't care about anybody but themselves. And the truth of the matter is, the members of union are our friends, our neighbors, the people we work with, the people we see every day,
yes,
the people we need every day, and because we really need, you know, that what this story proves is that we need one another.
Yes, we do.
And
yes,
and some of and responding to that call, especially to the lengths you went, we could all do a little bit more of that, and we, you know, at the risk of sounding super corny, we'd have a much nicer world, or at least a much nicer city, at any rate.
Yes, and I was also awarded Hometown Hero. In 2016, for doing a similar act, a woman left her bag on the train, and another passenger returned it to me. And it was a cell phone in the bag. So I called the last number that was called, and it was the woman's boyfriend. So he was able to get in touch with her at work and let her know that I had her bag. And I was working at 23rd Street at that time. And she rushed right over. And this was such a happy story because the woman had a picture of her mom that had passed away. So it was like the last picture that her mom had taken before she passed.
Wow.
So she broke down in tears. I mean, I was just so happy to give her back that bag with that picture. And that's all she cared about was that picture. Mm-hmm. And she was so happy. And because of that, I was awarded Hometown Hero.
And well deserved it was, Teresa. And we're happy. And we're happy that you're with the MTA, and we're happy that you're here in the studio today. And we want to thank you for all the hard work you do. And just before we close out here, we're going to do our usual wrap-up, which ends with our spotlight on American labor history. Now, on April the 10th, 1880, Frances Perkins was born under the name of Fanny Correll Perkins in Boston, Massachusetts. And 53 years later, in February of 1933, President-elect Roosevelt asked Frances Perkins to serve in his cabinet as Secretary of Labor. She agreed and went on to become the principal architect of the New Deal. She outlined for Roosevelt a set of policy priorities she would pursue. They included a 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, the abolition of child labor, Social Security, and yes, universal health insurance. She made it clear to Roosevelt that his agreement with these priorities was a condition of her joining his cabinet. Roosevelt said he endorsed them all, and Frances Perkins became the first woman in the nation to serve in a presidential cabinet. And that's all for this week, and we will be back next week with more good talk on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz right here on AM 970, The Answer.